Call frowned. No. No, I'm certain I was right.
You're not, said Miss Peregrine.
His gaze darted between them, paranoid, as if he were weighing the possibility they might somehow be in league against him. Then he seemed to let it go. This is just the first room, he said. The better souls are deeper in, I'm sure.
I agree, said Bentham. The farther we go, the older the souls will be, and the older the soul, the more powerful.
Then we shall plumb the very heart of this mountain, said Call, and eat it. We were prodded through one of the black doors, pistols at our ribs. The next room was much like the first, with coves combing its walls and doors leading into the dark. There were no windows, though, and just a single blade of afternoon sun slicing down the dusty floor. We were leaving daylight behind us. Call ordered Emma to make a flame. He ordered me to inventory the contents of the walls. I duly reported 3 jars, but my word wasn't enough. He made me tap each one with my fingernail to prove it was there, and pass my hand through dozens of empty coves to prove they were vacant. Next he made me read them. Heolstor, Ung Suen, Megan Wundor. The words were meaningless to me, unsatisfactory to him.
The souls of piddling slaves, he complained to Bentham. If we're to be kings, we need the souls of kings.
Onward, then, said Bentham.
We plunged into a baffling and seemingly endless maze of caverns, daylight a memory, the floor sloping ever downward. The air grew colder. Passageways branched off into the dark like veins. Call seemed to navigate by some sixth sense, confidently bounding left or right. He was insane, manifestly insane, and I was sure he was getting us so lost that even if we managed to escape him, we could expect to spend eternity trapped in these caves. I tried to imagine the battles that had been waged over these souls. Ancient, titanic peculiars clashing among the spires and valleys of Abaddon, but it was too mind-boggling. All I could think of was how terrifying it would be to be trapped down here without a light. The farther we went, the more jars were in the walls, as if plunderers had long ago raided the outermost rooms, but something had stopped them from getting too far. A healthy sense of self-preservation, maybe. Call barked at me for updates, but he'd stopped demanding proof of which coves were occupied and which were vacant, and only occasionally made me read a jar's label aloud. He was hunting bigger game, and seemed to have decided there was little worth bothering with in this part of the library. We went on in silence. The rooms grew larger and grander in their crude way, the ceilings rising and walls widening. The jars were everywhere now, filling every cove, stacked in totemic pillars in the corners, wedged into cracks and crevices, the cold that seeped from them refrigerating the air. Shivering, I pulled my arms close to my body, my breath pluming before me, the watched feeling that had haunted me earlier, creeping back. This library, so-called, was a vast underworld, a catacomb and hiding place for the second soul of every peculiar who had ever lived prior to the last millennium, hundreds of thousands of them. That great accretion of souls had begun to exert a strange pressure on me, compressing the air spaces in my head and lungs as if I were sinking gradually into deep water. I wasn't the only one feeling out of sorts. Even the guards were skittish,
startling at small noises and checking constantly over their shoulders.
"Did you hear that?"
Mine said.
"The voices?"
said the other one.
"No, more like water. Rushing water."
While they talked, I stole a quick glance at Miss Peregrine. Was she frightened? No. She seemed to be biding her time, waiting and watching. I took some comfort in that, and in the fact that she could have taken bird form and escaped her captors long ago, but hadn't. So long as Emma and I were prisoners, she would be. Maybe that was more than just her protective instinct at work. Maybe she had a plan. The air grew colder still, a thin sweat on my neck turning steadily to ice water. We trudged through a chamber so littered with jars I had to hopscotch around them to keep from kicking them over, though everyone else's feet passed right through them. I felt suffocated by the dead. It was standing room only here, the platform of a rush-hour train station, Times Square on New Year's Eve, all the revelers slack-faced and staring, unhappy to see us. I could feel this, if not quite see it. Finally, even Bentham lost his nerve.
"Brother, wait," he said, breathless, holding Call back. "Don't you suppose we've gone far enough?"
Call turned slowly to look at him, his face split evenly by shadow and fire glow.
"No, I do not," he said.
"But I'm sure the souls here are sufficiently..."
"We haven't found it yet!"
His voice sharp, brittle.
"Found what, sir?"
my guard ventured.
"I'll know it when I see it!"
Call snapped. Then he tensed, excited, and ran away into the dark.
"Sir, wait!"
the guard shouted, shoving us after him. Call vanished briefly before reappearing at the end of the chamber, illuminated by a shaft of faint blue light. He stood half-rimmed in it, transfixed by something. When we caught up to him and rounded a corner, we saw what it was. A long tunnel shining with azure light. A square opening at the other end was ablaze with it. I could hear something, too. A vague white noise, like rushing water. Call clapped his hands and whooped.
"We're close, by God!"
He skipped down the corridor, manic, and we were forced after him at a stumbling run. When we came to the end, the light that enveloped us was so dazzling that we all staggered to a stop, too blinded to see where we were going. Emma let her flames die. They weren't needed here. Squinting through my fingers, the space came slowly into view. Bathed in undulating curtains of gauzy blue light, it was the largest cavern we'd seen. A huge, circular space like a beehive, 100 feet across at the bottom, but tapering to a single point at its top, several stories above. Ice crystals gleamed on every surface, in every cove, and on every jar, of which there were thousands. They climbed to impossible heights, festooning the walls. Despite the freeze, there was free-flowing water here. It sprung from a tap shaped like a falcon's head, tumbled into a small channel that circled the room at the base of the walls, and flowed into a shallow pool at the edge of the room, ringed by smooth black stone at the far edge of the room. This water was the source of the cavern's heavenly light. Like the stuff inside soul jars, it glowed a ghostly blue, and it pulsed dimmer and brighter in regular cycles, as if breathing. It might have been oddly soothing, all this, like some Nordic spa experience, if it weren't for the distinct and human sound moaning at us beneath the water's pleasant burble. It was exactly like the moan we'd heard outside, the one I'd dismissed as wind whistling through doors. But there was no wind here, nor any possibility of hearing wind. This was something else. Bentham hobbled into the cavern behind us, winded and shielding his eyes, while Call strode to the middle of the room.
"Victory!"
he cried, seeming to enjoy the way his voice ricocheted between the towering walls.
"This is it! Our treasure house! Our throne room!"
"It's magnificent,"
Bentham said weakly, shuffling to join his brother.
"I see now why so many were willing to give their lives fighting for it."
"You're making a terrible mistake," Miss Peregrine said. "You mustn't desecrate this sacred place."
Call sighed dramatically.
"Must you spoil every moment with your schoolmarmish moralizing? Or are you simply jealous and mourning the end of your reign as the more gifted sister? Look at me! I can fly! I can make time loops! A generation from now, no one will remember there was ever such a silly creature as an Imbrin!"
"You're wrong!"
Emma shouted, no longer able to hold her tongue.
"It's you two who will be forgotten!"
Emma's guard moved to strike her, but Call told him to leave her be.
"Let her speak," he said. "It may be her last opportunity."
"Actually, you won't be forgotten," said Emma. "We'll write a new chapter in the tales about you. The Greedy Brothers, we'll call it, or the horrible, awful traitors who got what they deserved."
"A bit flat," Call said. "I think we'll call it How the Magnificent Brothers Overcame Prejudice to Become the Rightful God-Kings of Peculiardom, or something to that effect. And you're fortunate that I'm in such an excellent humor right now, girl."
His attention turned to me.
"Boy! Tell me about the jars here, and skip no detail, however small."
He demanded an exhaustive description, which I gave, reading aloud many dozens of their spidery, hand-scripted labels. If only I spoke old peculiar, I thought, I could have lied about what was written on them, maybe tricked Call into taking a soul that was weak and silly. But I was the perfect automaton. Blessed with ability, but cursed with ignorance. The only thing I could do was try to divert his attention from the most obviously promising jars. Though most of them were small and plain, a few were large, ornate, and heavy, with hourglass shapes and double handles and gem-toned wings painted on their surfaces. It seemed clear they contained the souls of powerful and important, or self-important, peculiars. The larger size of their coves was a giveaway, though, and when Call made me rap on them with my knuckle, they rang deep and loud. I had no tricks left. Call would get what he wanted, and there was nothing I could do about it. But then he did something that surprised everyone, something that seemed at first bizarrely generous. He turned to his guards and said,
"Now, who would like the first crack at this?"
The guards looked at each other, confused.
"What do you mean?"
said Bentham, hobbling toward him in alarm.
"Shouldn't it be you and I? We've worked so long."
"Don't be greedy, brother. Didn't I tell them their loyalty would be repaid?"
He looked again to the guards, grinning like a game show host.
"So, which of you will it be?"
Both of their hands shot up.
Me, sir, me! I'd like to!
Call pointed to the white who'd been guarding me.
You,
he said.
I like your spirit. Get over here!
Thank you, sir. Thank you!
Call pointed his gun at me, thus relieving my guard of his duty.
Now, which of those souls sounds like your cup of tea?
He remembered where I'd identified certain jars and began to point them out.
Yeth Faru. Something to do with water, flooding. Good one, if you've ever fancied a life under the sea. Wulsin Wirsend. I believe that's a sort of centaurish half-horse, half-man creature who controls clouds. Ben, sound familiar?
Bentham mumbled something in reply, but Call was hardly listening.
Stylehide, that was a good one. Metal skin. Could be useful in a fight, though I wonder if you'd have to oil yourself.
Sir, I hope you don't mind my asking, the guard said meekly. But what about one of the larger urns?
Call wagged his finger.
I like a man with ambition, but those are for my brother and me.
Of course, sir, of course, the guard said.
Then, were there any others? I gave you the best options, said Call, his tone edging toward warning. Now choose.
Yes, yes, sorry, sir.
The guard looked anguished.
I choose Yeth Faru.
Excellent!
Call boomed.
Boy, retrieve the jar.
I reached into the cove Call indicated and removed the jar. It was so cold I pulled the cuff of my jacket over my hand like a glove, but even through the fabric it felt like the jar was stealing all the warmth left in my body. The guard stared at my hand.
What do I do with it? He said. Take it like ambrosia?
I'm not certain, Call said. What do you think, brother?
I'm not sure either, said Bentham. It's not mentioned in any of the old texts.
Call scratched his chin.
Yes. I think you should take it like ambrosia.
He nodded, suddenly sure of himself.
Yes, that's the ticket, just like Ambro.
Are you sure?
Asked the guard.
Absolutely 100% sure, said Call. Don't be nervous. You'll go down in history for this. A pioneer!
The guard locked eyes on me.
No tricks. He said.
No tricks, I said. I uncorked the jar. Blue light shone out of it. The guard put his hand around mine, guided it and the jar above his head, and tilted back his face. He took a long, shuddering breath.
Here goes nothing,
he muttered, and tipped my hand. The liquid poured from the jar in a viscous stream. The instant it reached his eyes, his hand clenched so tight around mine that I thought my fingers would break. I wrenched free and leapt backward, and the jar fell to the ground and smashed. The guard's face was smoking and turning blue. He screamed and fell to his knees, his body shuddering, and then he pitched forward. When his head smacked the ground, it shattered like glass. Bits of frozen skull shot out around my feet. And then he was silent, and very, very dead.
Oh my God!
Cried Bentham. Call clucked his tongue as if someone had spilled a glass of expensive wine.
Well, drat, he said. I guess it's not like taking ambrosia after all.
His gaze roved around the room.
Well,
Now someone else has got to try it.
I'm quite busy, my lord,
cried the other guard, who had his gun trained on both Emma and Miss Peregrine.
Yes, I can see you've got your hands full there, Jones. Perhaps one of our guests, then?
He looked at Emma.
Girl, do this for me, and I'll make you my court jester.
Go to hell,
Emma snarled.
That can be arranged,
he snarled back. Then there was a loud hiss and a brightening of light at one edge of the room, and everyone turned to look. The liquid from the broken jar was dripping into the channel by the wall, and where the water and blue liquid had mixed, a reaction was taking place. The water bubbled and churned, glowing brighter than ever. Call was gleeful.
Look at this!
He exclaimed, bobbing on the balls of his feet. The quickly flowing channel pushed the bright, bubbling water around the edges of the room. We turned, watching it go, until it reached the shallow, stone-rimmed pool at the far end of the room. And then the pool itself began to churn and glow, a column of strong blue light rising from it all the way to the ceiling.
I know what this is, Bentham said, his voice trembling. It's called a spirit pool. An ancient means of summoning and communicating with the dead.
Hovering above the pool's surface in the column of light was a ghostly white vapor, and it was coalescing, slowly, into the form of a man.
But if a living person enters the pool during the summoning,
he absorbs the spirit being summoned, Call said. I do believe we've found our answer.
The spirit hovered, motionless. It was dressed in a simple tunic that revealed scaly skin and a dorsal fin that jutted from his back. This was the soul of the Yeth-Faru, the merman chosen by the guard. The column of light seemed a sort of prison from which it could not escape.
Well, Bentham said, gesturing at the pool. Are you going?
I'm not interested in another man's leftovers, Call said. I want that one.
He pointed to the jar I'd rung for him earlier, the largest of them all.
Tip it into the water, boy.
He pointed his gun at my head.
Now!
I did as I was told. Reaching into the oversized cove, I took the urn by both handles and tipped it toward me, carefully, lest it splatter and ruin my face. Bright blue liquid ran down the wall into the channel. The water went crazy, hissing and bubbling, the light it produced so bright that I had to squint. As the urn's liquid flowed around the room toward the spirit pool, my eyes darted to Miss Peregrine and Emma. This was our last chance to stop Call, and there was only one guard left. But he wasn't taking his eyes or his gun off the women, and Call still had his pistol aimed squarely at my head. It seemed we were still at their mercy. The great urn's liquid reached the spirit pool. The pool frothed and heaved as if a sea creature was about to break the surface. The column of light rising from it grew brighter still, and Yeth-Faru evaporated into nothing. A new vapor began to coalesce, much larger than the one it replaced. If this was taking the shape of a man, it was a giant one. Twice as tall as any of us, its chest twice as broad. Its hands were claws, and they were raised, palms upturned, in a way that implied great and terrible power. Call looked at the thing and smiled.
And that, as they say, is my cue.
He reached into his cloak with his free hand, pulled out a folded piece of paper, and shook it open.
"I just have a word or two I'd like to say first, before I officially change stations in life."
Bentham hobbled toward him.
"Brother, I think we'd better not dally any longer."
"I don't believe it!" Call shouted. "Will no one allow me a moment to glory in all this?"
"Listen!" Bentham hissed.
We listened. For a moment I heard nothing, but then, distantly, there came a high, sharp sound. I saw Emma tense, and her eyes widen. Call scowled.
"Is that a dog?"
"Yes, a dog. It was the bark of a dog, far away and lost in echoes."
"The Peculiars had a dog with them," Bentham said. "If it's following our scent, I doubt it's alone."
Which could mean only one thing. Our friends had overpowered their guards, and, led by Addison, they were coming after us. Yes, the damned cavalry was coming. But Call was moments from taking power, and who knew how far echoes traveled in these caverns? They could still be minutes away, and by then it would be too late.
"Well then," Call said, "I suppose my remarks will have to wait."
He tucked the paper back into his pocket. He seemed in no particular hurry, and it was driving Bentham mad.
"Go, Jack! Take your spirit, and then I'll take mine!"
Call sighed.
"About that. You know, I've been thinking. I'm not sure you could handle all this power. You're weak-minded, see? By which I don't mean unintelligent. On the contrary, you're more intelligent than I am. But you think like a weak person. Your will is weak. It isn't enough to be smart, you know. You've got to be vicious."
"No, brother, don't do this," Bentham begged. "I'll be your number two, your loyal confidant. Anything you need me to be."
"Serves you right," I thought. "Keep talking."
"This groveling is precisely what I mean," Call said, shaking his head. "It's the sort of thing that could only change the mind of a weak-willed person like yourself. But I am not susceptible to emotional entreaties."
"No, this is about revenge," Bentham said bitterly. "As if breaking my legs and enslaving me for years wasn't enough."
"Oh, it was, though," Call said. "True, I was cross with you for turning us all into Hollowghast, but having an army of monsters at my disposal turned out to be quite useful. But if I'm being honest, it's not even about your weak character. It's just... it's my own failing as a brother, I suppose. Alma can speak to this. I don't like to share."
"Then do it,"
Bentham spat.
"Get it over with and shoot me."
"I could do that," Call said. "But I think it would be more effective if I shot him."
And he aimed the gun at my chest and pulled the trigger. I felt the impact of the bullet almost before I heard the gun roar. It was like being walloped by giant invisible fists. I was knocked off my feet and thrown backward, and then everything became abstract. I was looking up at the ceiling, my vision tunneled to a pinhole. Someone was screaming my name. Another gun fired, then fired again. More screams. I was dimly aware that my body was experiencing a great deal of pain, that I was dying. Then Emma and Miss Peregrine were kneeling over me, anguished, shouting, the guard out of the picture. I couldn't understand their words, as if my ears were underwater. They were trying to move me, to drag me by the shoulders toward the door, but my body was limp and heavy. Then came a howl like hurricane winds from the direction of the spirit pool, and despite unbearable pain, I managed to turn my head and look. Call was standing calf-deep in the pool, his arms outstretched and head tilted back, in a state of paralysis as the vapor gripped him, merged with him. It poured into every opening in his face, tendrils of it sliding down his throat, ropes of it reeling up his nose, clouds of it settling into his eyes and ears. Then, in a matter of seconds, it was gone, the blue light that had shone throughout the cavern dimming to half strength, as if Call had soaked up its power. I could hear Miss Peregrine shouting. Emma picked up one of the guard's guns and emptied it at Call. He wasn't far, and she was a good shot. She must have hit him, but Call didn't so much as flinch. Rather than falling, he seemed to be doing the opposite. He was growing. He was growing very quickly, doubling in height and breadth in just a few seconds. He let out an animal scream as his skin split open and healed, split open and healed. Soon he was a tower of raw pink flesh and tattered clothes, his giant eyes electric blue, a stolen soul having finally filled the old blankness he'd nurtured so long. Worst of all were his hands. They had become huge, gnarled things, thick and twisted like tree roots, 10 fingers each. Emma and Miss Peregrine tried again to drag me toward the door, but now Call was coming after us. He stomped out of the spirit pool and bellowed in a bone-rattling voice, "Alma, come back here!" Call raised his awful hands. Some unseen force ripped Miss Peregrine and Emma away from me. They were pulled into the air and hovered there, flailing, 10 feet off the ground, until Call flipped his palms down again. Quick as a bounced ball, they slammed back to earth.
"I'll grind you between my teeth!"
Call howled, starting across the cavern toward them, his every footfall an earthquake. Adrenaline, it seemed, had begun to focus my vision and hearing. I could imagine no crueler death sentence than this. To spend my last moments watching the women I loved be torn apart. And then I heard a dog bark, and something worse occurred to me, watching my friends die too. Emma and Miss Peregrine ran. They had no choice. To come back for me now was impossible. The others began pouring out of the corridor. Kids and Imbrins, all mixed up. Sharon and the gallows riggers, too. Addison must have led them here, as he led all of them now, a lantern dangling from his mouth. They had no idea what they were up against. I wished I could warn them, "Don't bother fighting it, just run," but they wouldn't have listened to me. They saw the towering beast and threw all they had at it. The gallows men pitched their hammers. Bronwyn hurled a chunk of wall she'd carried in, winding back and letting it go like a shot put. Some of the kids had guns they'd taken from the whites, which they fired at Call. The Imbrins transformed into birds and swarmed his head, pecking him wherever they could. None of it had the slightest effect on him. The bullets bounced off. He batted away the chunk of wall. He caught the hammers between his giant teeth and spat them out. Like a swarm of gnats, the Imbrins seemed merely to irritate him. And then he spread his arms and his knotty fingers, the little feeder roots that dangled from them dancing like live wires, and slowly brought his palms together. As he did, all the Imbrins circling his head were pushed away, and all the peculiars were smashed together in a clump. He brought his palms together and folded them over and over as if crumpling a piece of paper. The Imbrins and the peculiars rose from the ground in a spherical crush of limbs and wings. I was the only one left alone, except Bentham. Where was Bentham? And I tried to get up, to stand and do something, but I could only lift my head. My God, they were being pulverized, their terrified screams echoing off the walls, and I thought that was it, that in a moment blood would pour from them like juice from a squeezed fruit. But then one of Call's hands flew up and began to flap in front of his face, waving something away. It was bees. A stream of Hugh's bees had flown out of the crush, and now they were in Call's eyes, stinging him as he let out a shattering howl. The Imbrins and peculiars fell to the ground, the ball they'd formed collapsing, bodies spilling out everywhere. They hadn't been crushed, thank God. Miss Peregrine, screeching and flapping in bird form, pulled people to their feet and propelled them toward the corridor. Run! Run! Go! Then she winged off for Call. He had dealt with the bees and was again spreading his arms, ready to scoop everyone up and splatter them against a wall. Before he could, Miss Peregrine dive-bombed him with her talons and raked deep cuts across his face. He spun to take a lumbering swipe at her, smacking her so hard she flew across the room, bounced off the wall, and fell to the ground, where she lay motionless. By the time he turned back to deal with the others, they had nearly disappeared into the corridor. Call extended his palm toward them, closed his hand, and scooped it back. But they were farther away, apparently, than his powers of telekinesis would reach. Bellowing in frustration, he ran after them, then flopped onto his belly and tried to wriggle into the corridor after them. He could just fit inside, though it was a tight squeeze. That's when, finally, I saw Bentham. He had rolled into the channel of water to hide, and now he was climbing out again, soaking wet but otherwise unaffected. He was bent over, his back to me, working at something. I couldn't see what. I felt like I was coming back to life. The pain in my chest was receding. I tried to move my arms, an experiment, and found that I could. I slid them up my body and over my chest, expecting to find a couple of holes and a lot of blood. But I was dry. Instead of holes, my hands found a piece of metal flattened like a coin. I closed my hands around it, picked it up to look. It was a bullet. It had not pierced my body. I was not dying. The bullet had embedded itself in my scarf. The scarf Horace had knit for me. He had known somehow that this would happen, and had made this scarf from the wool of peculiar sheep. Thank God for Horace. I saw something flash across the room and lifted my head. I could just do it. To see Bentham standing with his eyes ablaze, cones of hot white light beaming from his sockets. He dropped something, and I heard a tinkle of glass. He'd taken a vial of Ambro. I used all my strength to turn onto my side, then curled and began to sit up. Bentham hurried along the walls, looking up at the jars. He was studying each one carefully, as if he could see them. And then I realized what he'd done, what he'd taken. He'd been saving my grandfather's stolen soul all these years, and now he'd consumed it. He could see the jars. He could do what I did. I was on my knees, palms to the ground, pulled one foot under me, then pushed myself up to standing. I was back, risen from the dead. By then, Call had wriggled into the corridor and was halfway down it. I could hear my friends' voices echoing from the other end. They hadn't escaped yet. Perhaps they refused to leave Miss Peregrine behind, or me, possibly. They were still fighting. Bentham was running now, as best he could. He'd spied the other large urn and was heading right for it. I took a few limping steps toward him. He reached the urn and tipped it over. Its blue liquid hissed into the channel and began circulating toward the spirit pool. He turned and saw me. He limped for the pool, and I limped for him. The urn's liquid reached the pool. Its water began to rage, and a column of blinding light shot up toward the ceiling.
"Who is taking my souls?"
Call bellowed from the corridor. He began to worm his way back into the chamber. I tackled Bentham, or fell on him, whichever you prefer. I was weak and dizzy, and he was old and brittle, and we were just about a match for each other. We struggled briefly, and when it was clear I had him pinned, he gave up.
"Listen to me," he said. "I've got to do this. I'm the only hope you have."
"Shut up," I said, grabbing at his hands, which were still flailing.
"I won't listen to your lies." "He'll kill us all if you don't let me go."
"Are you insane? If I let you go, you'll just help him." I grabbed his wrists, finally. He'd been trying to get something from his pocket.
"No, I won't," he cried. "I've made so many mistakes, but I can put them right if you let me help you."
"Help me?
Look in my pocket."
Call was backing slowly out of the corridor, roaring about his souls.
"My vest pocket!" Bentham shouted. "There's a paper in it. One I carry with me always, just in case."
I let go of one of his hands and reached into his pocket. I found a small piece of folded paper, which I tore open.
"What is this?"
I said. It was written in old peculiar. I couldn't read it.
"It's a recipe. Show it to the Imbrins. They'll know what to do."
A hand reached over my shoulder and snatched the paper from me. I spun around to see Miss Peregrine, battered but human. She read the paper. Her eyes flashed at Bentham.
"You're certain this will work?"
"It worked once," he said. "I don't see why it shouldn't again. And with even more Imbrins."
"Let him go,"
she said to me. I was shocked.
"What? But he's going to..."
She put a hand on my shoulder.
"I know."
He stole my grandfather's soul! He's taken it! It's in him right now!
I know, Jacob.
She looked down at me, her face kind but firm.
That's all true and worse. And it was a good thing you caught him. But now you must let him go.
So I released his hand, stood up, with help from Miss Peregrine, and then Bentham stood too, a sad, bent-backed old man, with the starry black drippings of my grandfather's soul running down his cheeks. For a moment, I thought I could see a flash of Abe in his eyes, a little of his spirit there, sparking back at me. Bentham turned and ran for the column of light in the spirit pool. The vapor was gathering into the shape of a giant almost as large as Call, but with wings. If Bentham reached the pool in time, Call would have a worthy challenger. Call was nearly out of the corridor now, and he was raging mad.
"What have you done?"
he cried.
"I'll kill you!"
Miss Peregrine pushed me flat to the ground and lay beside me.
"There's no time to hide," she said. "Play dead."
Bentham stumbled into the pool, and immediately the vapor began funneling into him. Call had finally wriggled out of the corridor and lurched heavily to his feet, then ran toward Bentham. We were nearly crushed as one of his enormous feet crashed down not far from our heads, but Call arrived at the pool too late to stop Bentham from merging with whatever old great soul had been in that urn. Miss Peregrine's younger, weaker brother was already rocketing up to twice his original height. Miss Peregrine and I helped each other up. Behind us, Call and Bentham began to clash, the sound erupting like bombs. No one had to tell me to run. We were halfway to the corridor when Emma and Bronwyn sped out of it to meet us. They caught us by the arms and whisked us toward safety faster than our weak and battered bodies could have managed alone. We didn't speak. There was no time to do anything but run. No way to shout loud enough to be heard, but Emma's face, electrified with wonder and relief at the simple fact that I was alive, said it all. The black tunnel enveloped us. We'd made it. I looked back just once to catch a glimpse of the riot exploding behind us. Through clouds of dust and vapor I saw two creatures, taller than houses, trying to murder each other. Call choking Bentham with one spiky hand, gouging his eyes with the other. Bentham, insect-headed, thousands of eyes to spare, feeding on Call's neck with long, flexible mandibles and battering him with great, leathery wings. They danced, a tangle of limbs, slamming together into walls, the room coming down around them, the contents of countless shattered soul jars flying, a luminous rain. With that preview of my nightmares thus cemented in my brain, I let Emma pull me into the dark. We found our friends in the next chamber, swallowed by the dark, their only light a fading gleam from the lantern in Addison's mouth. When Emma fired a flame and they saw us loping toward them, worse for wear but alive, they let out a great whooping cheer. I saw them in her light and winced. They were in rough shape themselves, bloodied and bruised from being slammed around by Call, a few limping on sprained or broken legs. There was a momentary lull in the blasting noises coming from the cavern, and Emma was finally able to hug me.
"I saw him shoot you! By what miracle are you alive?"
"By the miracle of peculiar sheep's wool and Horace's dreams," I said. And then I kissed Emma, and broke away to find Horace in the crowd. When I did, I hugged him so hard his patent leather shoes lifted off the ground. "I hope one day I'll be able to repay you for this," I said, tugging on my scarf.
"I'm so glad it helped," he said, beaming at me.
The destruction resumed, the sound immense, unbelievable. Rocky debris rolled out of the corridor at us. Even if Call and Bentham couldn't reach us from where they were, they could still bring the whole place crashing down on our heads. We had to get out of the library, and then out of this loop. We ran, scraping and hobbling back the way we'd come, half of us a limping mess, the others acting as human crutches. Addison guided us with his nose, back through the maze and out the way we'd come. The sound of Call and Bentham's battle seemed to pursue us, growing louder even as we got farther away, as if they were growing. How big could they get? And how strong? Perhaps the souls from all the jars they'd broken were raining into the pool, feeding them, making them even more monstrous. Would the Library of Souls bury them? Would it be their grave, their prison? Or would it crack open like an eggshell and birth these horrors into the world? We reached the grotto exit and dashed once again into the orange daylight. The rumble behind us had become constant, a quake that reverberated through the hills.
"We must keep going," Miss Peregrine shouted. "To the loop exit!"
We were halfway there, stumbling through a clearing, when the ground beneath us shook so violently that we were all thrown off our feet. I'd never heard a volcano erupt in person, but it couldn't have sounded much scarier than the thunderous boom that echoed from the low hills behind us. We turned in shock to see acres of pulverized rock flying into the air. And then we heard, clear as day, the screams of Bentham and Call. They were free of the library now. They had torn through the cavern ceiling and untold depths of stone to daylight.
"We can't wait any longer,"
Miss Peregrine cried. She picked herself up and held aloft Bentham's crumple of paper.
"Sisters! It's time to close this loop!"
That's when I realized what it was he'd given us, and why Miss Peregrine had let him go. A recipe, he'd called it. It worked once. It was the procedure he'd tricked Call and his followers into enacting all those years ago in 1908. The one that had collapsed the loop they were in, rather than resetting their internal clocks as they'd hoped. This time the collapse would be intentional. There was only one problem.
"Won't that turn them into hollows?" asked Miss Wren.
"A hollow's no problem," I said. "But last time someone collapsed a loop this way, didn't it make an explosion big enough to flatten half of Siberia?"
"The Imbrins my brother coerced into helping him were young and inexperienced," Miss Peregrine said. "We'll do a better job."
"We'd better," said Miss Wren. Over the hill, a giant face rose like a second sun peeking over the horizon. It was Call, large as 10 houses now. In a terrible voice that trumpeted across the hills, he bellowed,
"Alma!"
"He's coming for you, miss,"
Olive cried.
"We must get to safety."
"In a moment, dear." Miss Peregrine shooed all of us peculiar children, and Sharon and his cousins, a good distance away, then gathered the Imbrins around her. They looked like some mystical secret society about to enact an ancient ritual, which, I suppose, they were. Reading from the paper, Miss Peregrine said, "According to this, once we start the reaction, we'll have only a minute to escape the loop." "Will that be enough time?" said Miss Avocet. "It'll have to be," said Miss Wren grimly. "Perhaps we should get closer to the exit before we try," suggested Miss Glassbill, who had just recently come to her senses. "There isn't time," said Miss Peregrine. "We have to..."
The rest of her sentence was drowned out by a distant but thunderous shout from Call, his words gibberish now, his mind likely melting from the extraordinary stress of rapid growth. His breath reached us a few seconds after his voice, a foul yellow wind that curdled the air. Bentham hadn't been heard from in a few minutes. I wondered if he'd been killed.
"Wish your elders luck," Miss Peregrine shouted to us.
"Good luck,"
we all cried.
"Don't blow us up,"
Enoch added. Miss Peregrine turned to her sisters. The 12 Imbrins formed a tight circle and joined hands. Miss Peregrine spoke in old peculiar. The others replied in unison, all their voices rising in an eerie, lilting song. This went on for 30 seconds or more, during which time Call started to climb out of the cavern, rubble tumbling down the hills where his massive hands grasped for purchase.
"Well, this is fascinating," Sharon said, "and you're all free to stay and watch, but I think my cousins and I will be going."
He began to walk away, then saw that the path ahead split 5 ways, and the hard ground had captured none of our footprints. He said, turning back.
"Does anyone happen to remember the way?"
"You'll have to wait," Addison growled. "No one leaves until the Imbrins do."
Finally, they unclasped their hands and broke their circle.
"That's it?" Emma said.
"That's it," Miss Peregrine replied, hurrying toward us. "Let's be on our way. We don't want to be here 54 seconds from now." Where the Imbrins had been standing, a crack was splitting open in the ground, the clay falling away into a quickly widening sinkhole, from which a loud, almost mechanical buzz issued forth. The collapse had begun. In spite of exhaustion and broken bodies and faltering steps, we ran, pushed faster by terror and awful apocalyptic noises, and by the giant lumbering shadow that fell across our path. We ran over ground that was splitting open, down ancient stairways that crumbled beneath our feet, back into the first house we'd exited from, choked with red dust from pulverizing walls, and finally into the passageway that led back to Call's tower. Miss Peregrine herded us through, the passageway disintegrating around us, and then out the other side, into the tower. I looked back to see the passage cave in behind us, a giant fist smashing down through its roof. Miss Peregrine, frantic,
"Where's the door gone? We must close it, or the collapse may spread beyond this loop."
"Bronwyn kicked it in,"
Enoch tattled.
"It's broken!"
She'd been the first to reach it, and, for Bronwyn, kicking down the door had been faster than turning its knob.
"I'm sorry," she cried. "Have I doomed us all?"
The loop's shaking had begun to spread to the tower. It swayed, spilling us from one side of the hall to the other.
"Not if we can escape the tower," Miss Peregrine said. "We're too high," cried Miss Wren. "We'll never make it to the bottom in time."
"There's an open deck just above us," I said.
though I wasn't sure why I said it, because leaping to our deaths seemed no better than being crushed in a collapsing tower.
"Yes!" cried Olive. "We'll jump!"
"Absolutely not!" Miss Wren said. "We Imbrins would be just fine, but you children..."
"I can float..."